The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Warkey, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning. The next matter on for oral argument is Grimm versus City of Zumbrota. Just to state the obvious, we're proceeding today by Zoom and not live and in person at the Judicial Center. But even though we can see each other clearly and we can see each other's names, we're only making an audio recording of the proceeding. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that for rebuttal. If the technology gets glitchy at all, try to bring it to our attention so we can pause and make sure that everyone is seeing and hearing everyone else appropriately. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Ava Cavaco, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Brandon Grimm, in this matter. A brief summary of the facts is this. My client tripped and fell on a curb in Zumbro Falls, which caused some severe injuries and multiple surgeries. The curb itself is unusually structured, and it was readily apparent at that some point in time, the City of Zumbro Falls saw fit to warn pedestrians of the curb, as evidenced by residual worn-off yellow warning paint. It is the appellant's assertion that the curb has been negligently maintained by the owner, City of Zumbro Falls.
Just to be clear, you're not alleging that the double curb design, you're not challenging that. You're challenging the failure to maintain it with the painted lines.
That is correct, Your Honor. We did not make a design defect argument at summary judgment. So the district court has held that the claim Mr. Grimm brought against the City of Zumbro Falls should be dismissed because it is barred by the city's statutory immunity, and that the incident Mr. Grimm suffered was open and obvious in nature. This court should reverse the district court's decision for two reasons. First, that to be protected by statutory immunity, there is a distinction between planning level conduct, which is protected, and operational level conduct, which is not protected by law. Moreover, to justify their decision of immunity, the district court stated in their summary judgment order that the city had no knowledge or constructive knowledge of the sidewalk's purported dangerous condition, which is simply not true. We presented multiple material issues of fact here to rebut this conclusion, which is one of the reasons why this case should continue to trial. Second, whether the curb in question is open and obvious is a fact question that should be determined and decided by the jury. Furthermore, the city's duty and liability is not excused by the open and obvious doctrine. As a result, the district court's ruling has created a reversible error that can be remedied by allowing Mr. Grimm's claim against the city of Zumbro.
Can I take you back to the statutory immunity theory?
Absolutely.
Mr. Tsai, on behalf of the city, has conceded that they didn't have any maintenance policy. Wouldn't it be true if the failure to have a maintenance policy was based on, money for a small city such as Zumbro Falls, or based on perhaps the political factors or anything else? Wouldn't that rise to an immunity level for the city?
That is a great question, Your Honor. And, I do... It's true that, statutory immunity is allowed when there's policymaking nature involving economic considerations. But to that specific point about their limited, budget, we absolutely concede that, they are our neighbors. We're located in Rochester, and we know that they have suffered a lot of nature issues, and know that they do need flood prevention. Like, absolutely, they're able to make that decision. But to the specific point about policy, that they should be immune because of an economic consideration. We argued at summary judgment that their inaction compared to what other cities do does not allow them to be immune to liability. For example, here in the city of Rochester, and when I went to law school in the city of St. Paul, those cities have policies where the business that is abutting a curb, or a resident homeowner that abuts a curb, is required to maintain that sidewalk and that curb. That policy costs the city nothing to require that the businesses against those curbs maintain that. And so we made this argument that an economic consideration was not, it didn't apply in this case. That's not the policy level issue that we are talking about when we say that this curb isn't maintained. Furthermore, this idea that the city had no appreciation or knowledge that this curb could be dangerous, it is simply false. You know, they in their affidavits and discovery, one of their employees said that they had volunteers come to paint the street curbs with yellow paint 3 times in the past 20 years. Now, we appreciate that volunteers are merely that. They're just volunteers. You can't force them to come back every year and repaint the curb. But that decision to direct that task to volunteers is operational in nature, not planning level. That means somebody who's not involved in the policymaking process, someone who doesn't show up at city council meetings or, you know, whatever governing body of the city makes these decisions, is not the same person that decided to have volunteers do this thing. And so, you know, in our exhibits that we submitted with our brief, as well as at summary judgment, when a person is walking off the sidewalk onto the street, you cannot tell that this curb is double curbed.
And I have a question for you, but I'm going to yield to Judge Larkin, who is actually using the hand maneuver, but I also have a question.
And mine is quick. You know, I'm aware that at common law, municipalities are responsible for maintaining their sidewalks in a safe manner. Is there any case law that talks about whether, you know, this curb situation is part of that sidewalk and part of that common law duty? I was not able to find any. Are you aware of any?
You know, Your Honor, you're absolutely on point in that regard. I've dug very deep and I don't find any common law that cites to that. And so truly, my primary argument for the court today is this is an issue of fact that should be allowed to be decided by the fact finder. And you know, until we have some, this may be an issue of first impression that needs a common law. And so...
So are you saying that there are factual issues as to the immunity question itself?
My argument at the statutory immunity is twofold. One, that the city of Zumbro Falls, you know, pointed at this economic in nature to in the statute. And then the lower court agreed that, hey, they had this meeting, they decided they don't have the money, so they don't, you know, this is fine, they're immune, that was erroneous in nature to decide that they are allowed to have statutory immunity on that point.
And are there any cases, I mean, something about that seems amiss to me, to say, well, a municipality has a common law duty to maintain its sidewalks in a safe condition, but then they could vote to say, well, we don't have the money to do that, so we're not going to do it. And thereby avoid their common law liability.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. You know, the statute, as well as Nisbam v. County of Blue Earth, says that, you know, as long as the municipality produces evidence that the conduct was policy making in nature and involving social, political, or economic considerations.
Okay. And so I guess my broader question, and maybe I'm overthinking this, but you know, this test we have for whether something is policy or operational, how does that apply when you're dealing with something that's already recognized as a common law duty? Are there any cases that talk about that you're aware of, or am I overthinking that? Because it just seems odd to me to say, well, we all accept a common law, you have a duty to maintain your sidewalk. And then to say, well, unless you decide you don't want to spend the money to do it, now that becomes a policy decision, so you have immunity. Any case law you can point us to resolve that tension?
Let me see.
And don't take time to do it now. I just thought if you knew through your research.
No, it's fine. I apologize, Your Honor. From when I wrote this brief, I did not find any additional case law to that point. I'd be happy to submit some supplemental brief if Your Honor, if that would help.
Not necessary. And I'll defer to Judge Workey with her question now.
that included part of my question, but I wanted to also, you got 6 minutes, and the immunity issue is of course important, but beyond that, whether there is immunity or not, we have the open and obvious danger determination. And I had a question on that in terms of if the danger was known to Grimm, because as I understand it, he went in the front door and navigated that curb setting when he went inside the establishment. Isn't that right?
Yes, that is right.
And before you answer that, is it also, do I also understand the record correctly that he had been there before?
Yes, okay. It is our understanding, and he did testify in discovery that he goes at least once a year when he goes camping with his sons in the Zumbro Falls area. So it's not that he's never been there before. But it's not a place he's super familiar with. He doesn't go there on a regular basis.
Do you agree that you could prevail on the immunity issue if we agree with your theory, but you still could lose as far as an open and obvious condition?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And, you know, we believe that our client deserves that chance with the court, whether he loses or wins. You know, he's been sorely injured. He was out of work for almost 2 years, and we believe that it's worth the fight.
And excuse me, loses is a bad choice of words, whether you prevail, yes, or don't prevail. I need to correct that.
Absolutely. I completely understand your point.
Perhaps this is a more appropriate question for opposing counsel, but do we have to look at, I mean, whether it's open and obvious, does that raise a fact question for the jury?
Yes, that is my...
I guess what I'm thinking is, if it's open and obvious, why did the city paint it when it had the resources to do so? And I don't know which way that goes, but if that's a reasonable way to view this, then is summary judgment inappropriate? And as I said, probably opposing counsel could address that better than you. That's a little bit of a softball unintended for you.
For sure. You surely stated my exact argument to the court today, Your Honor. You know, if we are allowed to proceed at trial, we have we have testimony, we have photos of how this may not be an open and obvious curb. If this was a regular neighborhood curb where you just step off, I would probably not be here today. But you know, it is kind of a tricky location, and I'm fully prepared to argue this idea that open and obvious is something that might not apply in this fact, and I do believe that you could get 12 neighbors to agree with me.
And open and obvious, I mean, and just walk me through the legal analysis. You know, you could have a person who's never been there before, who parked in an alley, went in through the back entrance. I'm aware of businesses that have front and back, and came out the front, had no idea that this double curb was there because you can't see it. Then yes, you have your client who's been there many times and has actual knowledge that it's there. Is the analysis different for those two potential plaintiffs when we look at whether it's an open and obvious danger? And if so, how?
It's possible. So my argument is based on, first, the common law case Olinson v. Lissouer County, that whether a condition presents a known or obvious danger is a question of fact for the jury and not for the judge to decide at summary judgment. And that, you know, questions of fact generally is a duty and responsibility of the fact finder. And
but let me narrow my question because the time is limited.
Yes.
Does the analysis change when we're presented with a plaintiff who has actual knowledge of the condition and then nonetheless encounters it? If so, how?
I think that the analysis does not change when put on the spot like this. And I think that the analysis is truly wrapped up in what issues of material facts do we have to present to the court, if allowed the opportunity, Your Honor.
No, we have decided, our court and the Supreme Court has decided cases of open and obvious as a matter of law. Not all open and obvious questions go to a jury. Do you agree with that or do you disagree? And what are the circumstances that distinguish when there's a fact question on that issue and when there and when it can be decided as a matter of law?
Let's see. Am I arguing, Your Honor? One of the biggest arguments we made is that the respondent and the lower court says that there's no evidence that existed in the record that there was a dangerous condition and that the city had any notice of the dangerous condition. That doesn't answer your question, does it?
Not quite on the same issue, no.
I apologize.
That's all right.
Let's see.
Your time's about expired, but go ahead and gather your thoughts. And
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Don't feel under pressure.
I do think that there is a distinction. In Lewis v. Lewis, Minnesota has held that that a landowner may not owe a duty of care to an entrant if the danger is known, appreciated, or obvious. So in our case, I think we would have a difficult time proving whether or not it is known with my client because he has been there. And it would, the burden would definitely be on us as to whether he appreciated it or if it was obvious to him.
Right. But I'm asking more. I mean, there's two different issues. One is whether your client was aware and whether therefore your client is going to may fail on that issue. My question goes to the legal issue of open and obvious. If a hazard is open and obvious, then even if there's, without regard to immunity, your client would not succeed. And you said that open and obvious is a fact question for the jury. And I'm just suggesting to you that we have case law that where courts of appeals in our state and other states on that general issue of common law have decided as a matter of law, the question of open and obvious. And I gather you're saying, no, that's a question for a jury. My question for you is, under what circumstances is the open and obvious issue one that can be resolved as a matter of law? And under what circumstances is it one for the jury to decide? How do we know the difference?
In terms of existing case law, I do apologize, Your Honor. I'm not savvy to it. But when I have done several of these open and obvious and slip and fall cases, and I will say that I have lost many times on cases in which something is readily apparent to the eye, that reasonable minds could not differ on whether this thing is something open and obvious. For example, I have lost on many an ice case where if you're outside and it's lower than 20 degrees, a person should just know that there will be ice on the sidewalk. I think that my case differs in that not every person knows, especially when it's not readily apparent to your eye, that there's going to be more of a drop off of a curb, that there's a different curb, that would be open and obvious to, you know, that reasonable minds would differ in my case.
Thank you. You can mull that around in your mind. If you come up with a different answer when you have 5 minutes of rebuttal time, you can feel free to pitch that one as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Evan Tsai. I represent the respondent in this matter, the city of Zumbro Falls. I know the court has already hinted that it has plenty of questions for me to answer, and I'd love to answer them. But before we get there, I want to point out some stuff. First of all, since around the 50s, patrons of the Buckwild Bar, the bar that's at the center of this controversy, as well as the bar's predecessor liquor establishments, have been navigating the sidewalk and the double curb that's at the heart of this controversy. Some of them may have been drunk, some of them probably not. And in all that time, nobody has ever had trouble walking across that uncommon sidewalk feature that ultimately is two steps.
When you say no one has had trouble navigating the steps, I'm assuming that's, I didn't, I'm not sure that you can say that based on the record that no one has ever had trouble.
Well, I'm saying that the city doesn't know about any instance in that 50-plus year history.
Mr. Tsai, why would the city have bothered to paint the yellow lines? I mean, to me, it seems that there is a concern by the city that they had their work crew go out and take the paintbrushes and paint the lines, and then they decided not to do it anymore.
Your Honor, is it possible that I could share a screen and so we can observe the paint on the sidewalk curb?
Are you producing a photograph that's in the record?
Yes.
If that's, I don't see any reason why not. We would, if we were in person, you could certainly present a display. So
all right.
If you'd like to do so, I don't know that you have, let me make sure that you have the capacity to share the screen. I don't think you're precluded from it.
Well, I want to be sure that we all understand what we're talking about. I'm showing you what's been marked as Exhibit 3, Your Honor. And you can see, first of all, where the appellant had marked where he believes he may have tripped. And second, to the left of where he marked where the paint was. And you'll see that the paint that is visible is on the vertical part of the curb. There's no indication that in the record why that was painted. I think that it's a fundamental assumption that everybody makes, that that curb was painted because they were trying to warn pedestrians. I don't think that's the case. That curb could have been painted to warn people that that's not an area available for parking, or it might have been there to denote that there might be a slight decline for people that are approaching the bar. I don't know.
That's a little dangerous because isn't that a question that has not been resolved?
Not at all, Your Honor. The question that is before the court about the open and obvious condition of that sidewalk is not what is visible to a passerby. It's whether upon a reasonable inspection that it is visible. And the lower court said it's visible upon when a reasonable person looks, they can see that there's a double curb feature. And not if you're leaving the bar and you're the appellant and you don't see it, that it's not obvious to that person.
Mr. Tsai, if you could stop the screen share, I think we've got an image now so we can go back to the regular view.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity.
And again, my questions were based on your assertion of statutory immunity. Mm-hmm. But I, again, will yield to Judge Larkin, who has a question.
Okay. As I understand, I'm looking at the standard for open and obvious danger. So the city's not liable for a known or obvious danger. And I think a person could reasonably conclude that this is visible and discernible, but then the city could nonetheless be liable if the city nonetheless should have anticipated the harm to Mr. Grimm or other pedestrians who are using the sidewalk curb. And I mean, that seems like a question of fact in this case.
It wouldn't be a question of fact if there are other alternatives for any reasonable pedestrian. There's nothing that requires the appellant or any other pedestrian to necessarily use the double curb step feature. Appellant cites in their case brief.
But does that really get, my question is, if the standard is, unless the city should have nonetheless anticipated the harm to Grimm. I mean, this isn't like someone who's walking, you know, across ice and it's not as thick as you thought. I mean, why shouldn't the city anticipate that people are going to use their sidewalks and to walk from the street up this curb to get to those sidewalks? It seems like there's at least arguably a reason to anticipate that, despite the fact that this double curb design is visible, despite the fact that it's, you know, possible people would be distracted and trip over it, the city arguably should nonetheless anticipate that people are going to encounter the double curb and travel over it, because that's how you get to the sidewalk and the city's businesses.
But that's not my understanding of the law, Your Honor.
Correct me then.
Okay. And the restatement requires, and the law generally requires, that in order for the city to expect harm from an open and obvious danger, the invitee or the pedestrian there has to be a condition in which either the pedestrian is going to be distracted such that they won't discover the open and obvious condition, or that pedestrians necessarily have to encounter that hazard. And the record that we have doesn't make that. It's not clear that that's the case. In fact,
well, if you park on the street where the city provides for parking, and you have a sidewalk that the city provides for walking on before you enter this establishment, it seems pretty obvious that the city is aware that individuals will use that course. That is a way that individuals will travel. And as to an obstruction, I mean, this is people come and go from the bar and they're carrying things. In this case, Mr. Grimm is carrying a case of beer and didn't see the elevation drop.
I don't think the record states that because he was carrying beer, he was necessarily distracted from his path.
I'm not saying he's necessarily distracted. But I'm responding to your. I was proposing an argument based upon your recitation of the law that if it's open and obvious and known, the city still may be liable if it's in an area where an individual might be distracted, where there's an assumption where individuals might come upon the hazard and not notice it because of something keeping their attention from it.
And then that's a fair point, Your Honor, but the law requires that the hazard has to be unavoidable. And I bring up, I wanted to talk about the Peterson v. Raleigh case.
How would you get from the sidewalk down to the street to your car without leaving the sidewalk and stepping onto the street?
Well, if we're engaging in speculation, then I can say that the appellant or any other pedestrian leaving the Buckwild Bar could have simply turned eastward and traversed the sidewalk a few feet and avoided the double curb entirely.
Right, but this assumes that it's kind of circular. If the individual is doesn't notice the hazard because of whether it's open and obvious or not, if he's carrying something that would distract him from noticing it, then there would be no reason to go and take a circuitous route. Why not take a straight line from the establishment to your car?
Right. But I don't think that's what the law requires. The law requires that for that open and obvious hazard to require attention from the city, that the open and obvious condition has to be inevitably unavoidable.
Counsel, does the record tell us whether the curving at the end of the block has the same design?
I believe we have photographs that have been admitted as exhibits from Mr. Grimm's deposition that show exactly that.
If anybody wants to use a sidewalk, how do they avoid the curb?
Well, so
are there ramps?
Actually, yes. I mean, the curb where Mr. Grimm had claimed to have tripped was part of a ramp that was declining to the east of the bar. So yes, he could have absolutely avoided that curb. And that's the point that I'm making, is that the law doesn't say, well, a city has to reasonably anticipate a danger if some people choose to walk that way, or maybe inadvertently walk that way. The law requires that a pedestrian has no choice. They either, their choice is a draconian or Hobson's choice. They either have to encounter that hazard, or they lose out on whatever opportunity they're making. And the Peterson case that appellant cites that I bring up is exactly that case. We have a guy who distributes sundry products who is parked in the middle of essentially an ice rink after a bad snowstorm. He has to make the choice of either parking there and walking a short distance over an open and obvious condition, or park in a different space, contend with traffic during that snowy day, which would expose him to more harm, or alternatively, just not do the job. Here, the appellant's not faced with that Hobson's choice. He doesn't have to take that open and obvious condition. He could walk around it. He could approach the bar from a different angle.
This case seems very different to me from the one that you're describing and others and circumstances like those. You've described a circumstance where the open and obvious condition is known to an individual who is injured by the condition.
Right.
When that individual chooses to navigate the danger instead of taking a different route. In this case, I think the allegation is that the plaintiff did not see the danger. And so I'm not sure that you're providing cases where there's a choice and that a choice is made essentially to incur the risk. In this case, there's no choice made because the risk is not apparent. At least the allegations would say so.
And that's understandable, Your Honor. I don't want to conflate, though, the analysis that the restatement and case law requires when it comes to open and obvious hazards that are unavoidable, and instances like this where there's a question of the openness and obviousness of the hazard. When it comes to open and obvious hazards, or the question that can be resolved by courts, the test there is not whether the injured party saw the hazard, but whether it was in fact visible by a reasonable person. To Judge Warkey's point, I'm not entirely sure that case law throws in the actual notice requirement. I believe that the fact that sidewalk or that curb previously was painted years before is irrelevant to the analysis of the objective test of visibility of that hazard. I don't know if that answered your question, Judge.
Does it matter? Well, going to the paint on the curb, you've provided a photo of what appears to be some the vestigial indication of painting. It looks like the painting is on the vertical surface, not the horizontal surface.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So then someone coming from Mr. Grimm's vantage point would not have seen the painting in any event.
That may very well be the case. And my suspicion is, although I don't know if the record is clear on this, is that there was at least one vehicle parked in front of the bar. And Mr. Grimm chose to walk around or next to and around the vehicle and then traverse the double curb sidewalk.
I mean, my point is that if the city was aware of a hazard in the past, assuming the yellow paint indicates awareness of there being a hazard, the way the city painted the curb would indicate that the city perceived a hazard for individuals walking towards the bar from the street onto the sidewalk, not the other way.
I don't know if it's fair to make that kind of speculation, Your Honor. And even still, painting something that is an open and obvious hazard, that doesn't make it less open and obvious. I think it's Hollerich v. Johnson, or I think Lawrence v. Hollerich. A woman sued a neighbor because of a steep hill, and she decided to go down the steep hill and ran down, hit a utility pole, and then hit her head on the sidewalk and sued, saying that the sidewalk was negligently maintained.
I will just say only a lawyer for the city would chuckle at describing someone running down the hill and hitting.
Well, I mean, I think the circumstances in retrospect our profession requires a certain amount of glibness. But the point that I'm making is putting a sign next to the steep hill saying steep hill doesn't make the condition less obvious, right? It's still a steep hill. There's still a double curb.
In other words, I think if I can interpret your argument, you're suggesting that the city's decision to warn against the hazard is just an extra prophylactic measure, but not required by law when the hazard is already open and obvious.
You are correct, Your Honor.
Well, in that regard, I was kind of surprised you didn't begin your argument by saying the city has provided its warning by naming itself the way it has. Yeah, sorry. All right. Judge Warkey just got that. You know, I'm a dad. I'm allowed to offer a dad joke every now and again. All right. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counselor Appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I did find the examples when clearly obvious hazards have been decided as a matter of law for the Minnesota Supreme Court. It was definitely in my brief and I forgot about it. And it's thank you, Mr. Tsai, for bringing it up, because one of the examples is walking down a steep hill. The Minnesota Supreme Court has said that hazards such as walking into a low-hanging branch, walking down a steep hill, walking into a large planter on a sidewalk, and walking across a 20-foot square pool of water or skydiving over a lake are clearly obvious hazards, of which that it is a matter of law and the court is very much allowed to rule over it. I think that my case, the current matter at hand, is distinguished in that when a person is going to walk into a low-hanging branch or is able, you know, to see the steep hill, all of these hazards that the Minnesota Supreme Court has identified are hazards that can be clearly seen before encountering the hazard. A person can observe the steep hill before deciding that they get to, that they're going to encounter it or they're, or, you know, traverse it, or a person can see a 20-foot square pool of water and decide, yep, I'm going to go through that water.
Okay, well, let me, I get the point you're making, but this is what I want to ask. So yes. Does it matter that, this is, brings me back to my question about the person who came in through the back, walks out the front, has not seen the dual curb, but your client clearly saw it, knew it was there, and walked over it to get in? I mean, yes. When we analyze this, do we say, well, if it was someone who'd never been there, they've got a case, but your client doesn't because he knows about the danger? He has actual knowledge, subjective knowledge. How does that fit in?
That is a great question, Your Honor. I think that reasonable minds could disagree on whether it applies to someone who has just stepped over it or not.
Oh, I mean, if would you agree there's no way you can step up? It's clear that, it seems clear to me that whether it was the city or the establishment or whoever decided to add this extra step, there's a significant drop from the surface of the sidewalk down to the street. And so you have this step essentially built into the curb. I can't imagine, given that height, that anyone who is going up this curb could navigate it without falling unless you saw it. In other words, it seems to me clear enough that your client had to have had actual knowledge of the step by having gone into the bar in the same direction he took leaving the bar.
I see what you're saying, Your Honor. And so this is in discovery at the district court level, but the curb is not the same height across the entire way. The document that Mr. Tsai put up earlier shows that, you know, it goes smaller from one end of the bar, then goes up higher and comes back down again. And so if a person does not step up in the same place that they step down, they do not encounter the same level of height, which is why had it been painted, you'd be able to see the difference in height from road to sidewalk.
But they would still encounter a step.
You're correct. Yes, they would.
And that's the point I'm getting at, that if you're walking up, it would be hard for me to imagine someone in the broad daylight, this wasn't at night, in the daylight. Yes. And again, we're talking about someone who's your client, who's not in the best position, at least compared to others, because your client has navigated this in the past. It's not just this day. It was previous that he's gone in and out. So I'm not sure how the difference in levels matters if there's a step that your client had to navigate going in to the bar on this very day.
I understand your assertion, Your Honor. And I think that even though he did navigate that same curb, you know, coming out of the bar, the double curb is hard to see in plain view. And that
And I would imagine his view was blocked by whatever he was carrying, wouldn't it have been? I mean, it came out, I think it was a case of beer, wasn't it?
Yes, and some
groceries. My recollection is they're pretty big.
Yes, indeed. And so, you know, all of these facts combined, we believe that if we were allowed to present all of these facts questions to the jury, that it would be possible to prevail for our client, Your Honors. And, you know,
before you, I know your time's expired, but I want to probe a little further the question that I was asking Mr. Tsai. So in the past, when you're pointing to the fact that the city painted the curb to indicate that, I suppose, the city had a duty to warn.
Yes.
And they recognize that duty. But we know that yellow curbs tend to also mean no parking. We don't know whether the yellow meant no parking or that there was a hazard. Let's assume it meant that there was a hazard and the city was aware of it. Would you agree with Mr. Tsai that the evidence would show the painting was not on the entire surface? It was on the vertical plane that would be observable when you're walking up towards the sidewalk, but not down from the sidewalk.
Your Honor, I believe that in discovery, when we submitted a bunch of photos, and so in my appellate brief, Exhibit E, you can see that there is faded yellow on the horizontal plane when you're walking away. It's just, or walking towards the curb, it has just faded and not been maintained, negligently maintained, if I may say.
Of course, you may. Thank you to both counsel. Your time has expired. Thank you to both counsel for your briefing in this matter.